where we're going to spend most of our time this morning, and we're going to look at what is known as a parable, a story that Jesus tells. But to get at that, just to kind of set it up, for me, if you don't know me or as you get to know me, when I begin and we're going to jump into the scriptures, we have to call context, context, context. Who is this being written to? Why did they write it? Why did they speak it? What is going on? Because it helps to first know why was this first being told and what is going on to help us figure out how that means something to us in our day and time as well. And so for us, to get a picture of this, we live in a society that is largely driven by the individual. It's very individualistic. And so we talk about the so-called self-made man or self-made woman. We have mantras. You can do it. You can be it. You do you. Is one that I hear, like, you can be what you want, go do that, you can achieve it. And this can be both encouraging, that's a good thing, it can be encouraging, but it also can be deceptive. It can also be deceiving that we just always say, you can do it. As an individual, you can do this and have your thing. And then too often within that, friends and community then often happen by how we choose them. The way I would say it is we often kind of say, I'm going to create my community. I'm going to craft it. I'm going to curate my life in a very specific way. And this happens and we understand it. And it's not new. In fact, Jesus kind of addressed this idea, though, of when we just say, no, I'm going to have what I want and as I want it and try and keep all other things out. Jesus has a word for us today that I believe because he spoke into it in the first century. And so we're going to be in the Gospel of Luke. Jesus does what I would say is he gives this kind of larger sermon, and it essentially has five parts because there are five different stories. But as we're going to look at the audience of the day, there's an audience that's kind of been moving with him as he moves along and does these teachings, and these people are following him, and it's as if he picks up on, well, for us to do this, he's going to basically go, I'm going to tell a story. And I'm going to tell another story. Oh, and you're following me still. Oh, I'm going to tell another story. And I'm going to tell another story. And there's a theme. There is something that he's getting at. There's a way of life that he's inviting them into. And what he does is he tells stories to get at that. Stories, rather than just lecture. And he's not just saying, well, here are the bullet points. He's instead riffing and telling different stories and pulling stories that they might know and tweaking them and playing with them. And he does that. And so we're going to look at the context, kind of how the whole thing begins with the audience of who he's talking to. And then we're going to zoom in on the last story of this kind of teaching sermon that he does. And we'll zoom in onto that. And then it'll kind of hopefully get us where we need to go. So we'll begin with the context. And we begin with the context in Luke chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. And this at least gets at the audience. So we'll throw that up on screen. So Luke 15, verse 1 and 2, it says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus. Interesting. These people gather around to hear Jesus. And it says, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, another group of people, are gathering around too. And it says, the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, they muttered. This man, Jesus, welcomes sinners and eats with them. So they teach the law and they step back and they think there's a way of life and they're like, man, this guy is allowing, not just allowing these riffraff is how they would say it. Tax collectors are kind of despised people in the first century. And sinners, well, they're unclean people. And they're gathering around Jesus, and not only is he okay with them gathering around, he's sharing a meal, which is a sign of friendship. And he's doing this, so they're sitting around, and they are muttering. So then you kind of, if you know what muttering then is, you go, you have to kind of read it in that voice then, right? This man welcomes sinners and eats with them. It's that kind of vibe. And the word in Greek for mutter, which I've said before, it's just a fantastic word. It's diagonguzo. Diagonguzo. And so you're like, oh, well, yeah, they got around and they were diagonguzo. And what this means, though, The word means a group of people getting together and complaining. So in the first century, they call that muttering. Nowadays, we call it the holidays. Maybe a family reunion. I'm not sure. But this idea of people gathering together and kind of muttering like they're grouchy. But this is his audience. So you have this mishmash of humanity gathering around listening to Jesus. And what he launches into is he tells stories. And he goes in and he begins to tell these stories. So that's the context, this mishmash of humanity with some religious elite bothered by the fact that there is some riffraff around and they're like, ugh. And Jesus is like, okay, now that I got you all with me, I'm going to tell some stories. And in Luke 15, right from there, he tells what is known as a triple parable. He tells three parables in a row. And so what those look like, we will get into in a little bit. But we're going to head to the last story. So we've at least got the audience. And we're going to look at the last story. And so we're going to be in Luke chapter 16. We'll have all the text on the screen. And we're going to read this story found in verses 19 to 31. So this is the last of five stories that Jesus tells. And this is called a parable. And Jesus says this to the audience. There was a rich man who was dressed in purple and fine linen and lived in luxury every day. At his gate was laid a beggar named Lazarus, covered with sores and longing to eat what fell from the rich man's table. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. The time came when the beggar died and the angels carried him to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. In Hades, where he was in torment, he looked up and saw Abraham far away with Lazarus by his side. So he called to him, "Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue because I am in agony in this fire." But Abraham replied, "Son, remember that in your lifetime you received your good things while Lazarus received bad things. But now he is comforted here and you are in agony. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been set in place, so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone cross over from there to us." He answered, "Then I beg you, Father, send Lazarus to my family, for I have five brothers. Let him warn them, so that they will not also come to this place of torment." Abraham replied, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen to them." "No, Father Abraham," he said, "but if someone from the dead goes to them, they will repent," which is change their mind about how they are living. He said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead." That's a weird story. That's an odd story. It's an interesting story, and it raises lots and lots of questions. Now, here's the thing. When we go context, first thing to know is through verse 26, there are actually seven versions of this story in rabbinic literature, pre-Jesus. Jesus didn't make this story up. He's pulling from their history, the Jewish history anyways. He's pulling a story that actually a lot of them would know, and he tells the story again. He gives this version of it, he tells through verse 26. So they would be like, oh, interesting, he's doing that. And the original point of that story was just to say that there would be a day that comes where there's going to be a great reversal. And what Jesus is saying then is, hey, that day of a great reversal of roles, of things, it's now. The kingdom of God is among you. It's happening. So he's letting them know this. It's at hand. But what Jesus does with this parable, what he often does with things is he tweaks it or he adds something in such a brilliant way. And what he does here is this story is there already, and then he adds the five brothers part. He does make that. This is him going, let me go ahead and riff and take this story, but I'm going to add a piece. Oh, by the way, this rich man has five brothers, and he has this dialogue, because what Jesus is doing here in a brilliant way, which he does all throughout these stories, is he takes his audience and he places them in the story. So the five brothers he's talking about are the Pharisees. He's like, let me take you and put you in the story and see if that will wake you up. So he places his audience in the story. Now, when we hold up the context and the conversation that Jesus has been having with the Pharisees, beginning in chapter 15, we find that they are constantly criticizing Jesus for hanging out with the losers and the outcasts. So Jesus keeps riffing parables and placing them in the stories with the invitation, will you wake up? Will you see things differently? It's always an invitation by how he tells the story. Will you get this? And basically, we can essentially say what Jesus has been teaching, what he's inviting them into is, will you love God by way of loving your neighbor? Will you love God by seeing God in your neighbor? Will you love God by how you interact with your neighbor? He's essentially touching on this with all these stories that he tells by the triple parable. There was a lost sheep. There are 99 found, but there's one lost sheep, and this shepherd goes out to find it. Well, this is what God is like. There was a woman who had 10 coins, and she lost one coin. She searches to find this long lost coin. This is what God is like. There was two brothers, and the younger one ran off and became lost, threw himself to it. He came home, and the father welcomed him home, embraced him. This is what the Father's like. And he keeps basically throwing out, will you be like this? Will you celebrate the lost being found? Will you be ones who seek for that which is lost rather than constantly just criticizing and saying, you're lost, so you're out. You're lost, you're gross. Instead, he's saying, will you see things differently? Because that's what the prophets and the prophets of the law, Moses, that's what they were always calling Israel to. Will you be this kind of people? So he's just reminding them, hey, you guys, your prophets, this is what they were always calling you back to when you left it. Then in Luke 16, Jesus speaks of not dividing your loyalty. So after the triple parable, then you get into Luke 16, and he does another teaching, and this one is specifically about don't divide your loyalties between God and money, because it's too easy to be devoured by the love of money and so despise God, which is another way of saying focusing only on yourself. When you become engrossed and devoured by this love of money, what you do is you're self-centered, you're self-focused, and you're losing sight of your neighbor when you're consumed by the love of money. You will no longer, then you'll look at your neighbors, are you trying to get it? Are you trying to hoard in on my, this is my stuff. Are you in the way of my stuff? And he's like, and you're losing that. So he does a teaching on the love of money and neighbor. So now when we understand the five brothers in our parable we're looking at, the five brothers in the parable to be the Pharisees, and the chasm and the torment being a picture of them intellectually knowing the law. They intellectually know it. They study it. They teach it. But they don't have a heart knowledge. They're missing the drive of the teaching. So he's pointing out, he puts them in there and he says, you all have Moses and the prophets who have been doing this. And then this rich man says, oh, no, you got to send somebody else to wake them up. And he's like, if you don't get it now, I'm not sure who, even someone coming from the dead, coming back from the dead, I don't know if that's going to cut it. Which is also very interesting in light of Jesus, because what's going to come? He's like, you know what? I bet if someone died and came back from the dead, you probably still wouldn't get it. Ow, ouch, would be how it did. So, but here's the thing. With this parable, this is less about, because a lot of times what people do with this is less about a future heaven and hell and far more about the present life. Because he's framed this and he's put it in the present life. Where this is, because people are like, oh, so this is like heaven and hell. This is the, and it's like, yeah, but how did he frame it? How you live now, how you engage and pay attention to life now, that's where it begins. And it actually has eternal implications, but we have to begin with the right here and right now. So then a question would be, if we think of what we often call the parable of the prodigal son, that was the third story in the kind of the triple parable. If you know that story or have any inkling, the younger son running off, the younger son coming home, the older son is all bent out of shape and ticked off that the younger brother came home and that the father accepted him. And he's bent. It raises a question for us. Did the return of the younger brother, the prodigal son, who it says in there was dead and has come back to life, did that convert the older brother? Did he go, oh, he's home. Yes, this is fantastic. Because the older brother, by the way, is the Pharisees, is who Jesus puts the Pharisees in the story as the older brother. Did it convert them or him? Now, we can't say definitively because the story ends with a question. Are you going to come into the party, older brother? So we can't say definitively, but it ends with the older brother outside of the party, criticizing his father and basically gnashing his teeth at his dad with bitterness and resentment. Doesn't look good. It doesn't look good. But here's the thing, and it's important with all these stories. The father in that story, the father didn't exile the older brother. The father didn't exile him. It was his refusal to forgive and extend grace to his younger brother, along with his belief that he deserves more from his dad and deserves that, that actually exiles himself. Because he's not willing to forgive and extend love. And he lives with this, I think, as I'm owed. I deserve this entitlement. He exiles himself. In other words, I would say this. Discussions about hell are really about refusing to love and forgive. A refusal to receive grace and extend grace, it's choosing to stand outside the party. We do that. They did that. You make the choice to stand outside the party and live with such an attitude. So if we talk about hell, if you will, if you want to find hell, walk the path of the rich man in our parable. Just walk that path. These parables are stories that Jesus is telling. Here's the thing. Here's the invitation that I would say. It's an invitation for our hearts to develop or deteriorate. We hear these stories, and does it open us up? And does it have us go, I'd like to grow. I need an expanded heart. It's an invitation to love more, forgive more, or our heart to deteriorate, as in like the older brother in the one parable where he's like, no, I deserve. I'm owed. I work harder. Look at him. He squandered some stuff, but how dare you welcome him home? We should throw him off. He doesn't belong. Get out of here. And that is our heart shrinking. And so to make these stories about a literal picture of heaven and hell, well, it kind of misses the point and the depth of it all. To make eternity only about a prayer said at childhood summer camp, but not about the day-to-day grace received and then extended to our neighbor, would be to walk the path of the Pharisees, who lived with plenty of head knowledge, but deeply lacked an ever-expanding heart knowledge. Prayers to God, inviting God into our lives, are beautiful and needed, but to say that only that and not how we live in the day to day today would be to miss so much of life. So now, here's the fun. Now that we have the story framed, that was context, now we can actually look into the story. So that was my intro. Now we get to get into the teaching. Isn't that awesome? I think it's fantastic. I just love it. So what we have is the story frame. That's just to kind of frame the whole thing. Now what we have is there are three characters in our story. In our last parable, rich man, Lazarus, Abraham. It's just the title of it sadly says the rich man and Lazarus, but there are three characters in the story. And you need to hold on to the third character, Abraham, Father Abraham, as it's said in there. Take that and hang on to that because that's going to be important. And we're going to come back to that in a minute. But let's now unpack the parable. There is a rich man dressed in purple and fine linen. What we need to know, purple is a symbol of royalty and fine linen is what the priests wore. In the Hebrew scriptures, it's what the priests wore, and it's a symbol of royalty. So this guy is a picture of the religious elite. That's what Jesus, when he tells the story, it's a picture of the religious elite. And he is the one who calls Abraham Father Abraham, which what that means is he's educated in the religious order. This person in the story. He's very educated in the religious order. The beggar is named Lazarus. He's dressed in sores, I guess you would say. He's covered in them, in fact. The rich man lived in luxury every day. Lazarus, on the other hand, is just looking for scraps to fall his way. Lazarus just wants some daily bread. Man, daily bread would be great. Even the dogs came and licked his sores. That is a picture of mercy. So the dogs are at least extending just a hint of mercy, which is actually more than can be said of the rich man. Ugh. You see, the story is already going, these dogs actually have more mercy than the rich man. Ouch. Ouch. Again. Now, there's a gate at the beginning of the story, and it can be seen as keeping Lazarus in particular out, right? But it also can be seen as keeping the rich man in. Isolated, you know, from those people. Apparently, the gate in the present in the story becomes a chasm on the other side of life. The gate in the beginning of the story essentially becomes a chasm on the other side of death. Now let's go to verse 26. Verse 26 says, "And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been set in place so that those who want to go from here to you cannot." I find it so fascinating when you study. It begins with those who are on this side actually want to go there, because those who are here and want to go down to Hades have a desire to rescue. Oh, that looks terrible. I would want you to be with me. That's actually first what's happening, because they would want to. That's their desire, is I'd like to include you. Because they apparently desire to rescue those in Hades. So really, again, this is a statement about the posture in the present life, correct? Many of the differences between Lazarus and the rich man turn out to be barriers that keep them apart. So I want to look at them. We'll throw these up on screen. They look different. The rich man is in fine linen. Lazarus is covered with sores. They're socially different. There is the status of the wealthy versus that of a beggar. Their values, the rich man values luxury. You know, Lazarus is like, man, just some daily bread would be good. So their values are different, but their differences become barriers to actually being together, which offers us some insight for how our world sometimes functions today. So I'd like to look at that. So if we could zoom into our world. There was a recent study done in West Michigan that asked the question on whether or not we would like to see our communities be more diverse. There was a study given, would you like your community to be seen more of diversity? And if not, what are your reasons? If not, what are the reasons? The majority of people said, no, I don't want my community to be more diverse. The number one reason for that was, I don't want my house and property value to drop, and I don't want to see an increase in crime. Do I have to name it? What's the problem there? Good. I I remember taking the survey, and then I remember seeing the results and being sick to my stomach when I saw my community in there and their responses. I literally was ill. Oh, is that how we feel? Interesting. Then, 2 weeks ago, the news reported that Habitat for Humanity has a project they've been pitching that where they want to build 116 affordable homes in Naples, Florida. This project has continually been shut down by the surrounding residents. The residents shut it down, and here is the central reason, and I quote from it, "We just don't want any affordable housing near us." The new homes, then here's the thing, the new homes would be completely surrounded by either lakes, preserves, or other land, but the nearby neighbors say, "That's not enough, we want more." So Habitat for Humanity agreed to build 8-foot concrete walls around parts of the neighborhood, and then those would be connected by chain link fence. This got the approval of the residents then. But here's what the project manager for Habitat for Humanity said. "These concessions to build the wall that we made are to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars. There are some families now we will not be able to help because of those concessions." One of the residents said, and I quote, "I'm not going to judge, but I'm just glad they're going to have the wall." I'm not a racist, but those people aren't welcome. Okay. The thing is, this almost sounds like a modern day parable, but sadly, heartbreakingly, this is a true story. Just reported on 2 weeks ago. Diversity, not in my neighborhood, not in my backyard. Do you see what's being said here? Those people, not in my backyard. Not unless we build a concrete wall. Because mine, and me are the driving values behind this posture, which is a barrier to being a good neighbor. Are we having a good time this morning? So back to Jesus' parable. The rich man also desires for Lazarus to come to him. We do see that, right? But for a very different reason. Let's throw up verse 24. "Father Abraham, have pity on me and send Lazarus to dip the tip of his finger in water and cool my tongue." The rich man still views Lazarus as beneath him, lower, and one who should serve him. Even though he's in Hades, he says, "Yeah, could you go ahead and have him serve me? You know, that guy?" The chasm in this parable is actually created by the posture of the rich man's heart. That's what's creating this posture, or this chasm. He has a ranking system to which he is on top, conveniently, and Lazarus is on the bottom. Now let's return to the three characters and look at them, because there is the beggar, and he has a name, Lazarus. There is the rich man, not given a name. He's just given the title, whatever you want to call it, rich man, which is a designation based on what he is apparently known for, accumulation and luxurious living. That's all he gets in this story. That's what you are all about? You can be called rich man then. And then there is Abraham, Father Abraham. This is really important because Abraham, in the scriptures, it was considered the father of the people of the one true God. He is the father of the children of the one true God. And his story is found in the book of Genesis, which is the first book in our scriptures. So we're going to look at that. Genesis 18:18 tells us Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all nations on earth will be blessed through him. Interesting. And then if you read Abraham's story, at one point in the story, Abraham and his nephew Lot have so much, they're wealthy actually, and what they have, the land in which they live, is not able to sustain them, so they have to separate and go separate ways so that they actually can spread out and have the land sustain them. And what's interesting as you read Abraham's story then, he leaves and lives a life of radical generosity, blessing all other nations. Fascinating. He in the story is listed as, and here is also a wealthy person. But this person lived with radical generosity and love for neighbor to the tune of all people can step back and go, that began with a person, became a community, became a complete people, and all of us are blessed by them. They were incredible. They are incredible people. They are generous people. They are hospitable people. So this, alongside the context in which Jesus has been teaching, which, by the way, the word parable means to set alongside of. In other words, Jesus says, I'm going to tell you a story. I'm going to set alongside of these truths that I've been teaching stories. I'm going to set these stories alongside of these truths and see if you can pick it up. Because this parable of the rich man Lazarus and Abraham follows Jesus telling a parable about not serving two masters, money and God. And in Luke 16:13, in that story, he says this, hey, you know what? You can't serve both God and money. Verse 14, the Pharisees, here we are, it says, who loved money, heard all of this, and were sneering at Jesus. At the beginning of Luke 15, they were doing what? They had a case of diagon guzo. They muttered at Jesus. Now they're sneering at Jesus. And because words are so fantastic, ekmuk terezu. How about is that? Ekmuk terezu. How fantastic is that word? So they went from diagon guzo. Now they have a case of ekmuk terezu. Well done there. You know what that word means? And this, to deride by turning up the nose. Have you ever been around somebody and you're like, ah, I know, but what about this? And yeah. You now can say, oh, sweet Barbara, you have a case of ekmuk teruzo. Apparently. What? I do. You should get that checked out. You really should. Words. Here's the thing. Jesus has been creatively riffing on story after story after story, inviting the Pharisees and the teachers of the law to wake up and see the divine image in each and every person, even in those people. To not view others, especially the differences in others, as barriers, but to be able to see past those differences and see the divine spark that lies at the very heart of every single person who was created by God. Can you see past those differences and see the divine spark in each person, the deeper essence within? Whatever their income, whatever their wardrobe, whatever their school of choice, however they voted, they are still created in the image of God, believe it or not. They have the divine spark in them to see that. Jesus, in fact, offers, will you take my eyes? See as I see. Stop sneering and muttering and start loving and caring and living generously is the invitation. Because to serve another master rooted in me and mine, my money, my stuff, is to exile one's self. We do that, not God. God actually honors our choices. Oh, that's how you want to be? You can have that. I won't stop you. I will continually invite you into a new way and invite you to have new eyes. But if that's how you want to live, you may have that. And oh, by the way, in this story, apparently the present has implications that go on and on and on. If you want to live that way, God says, I'll let you. But man, it is not a pretty scene, and it's not heading in a good direction. And then, if you want to choose that hellish way of living, you can have it. Yet here's the beautiful, wonderful piece. God is always relentlessly pursuing us, searching for us in our lostness. All these stories of the one who seeks until there is found. And when the lost is found, the best parties are thrown. Ah, the lost has come home. The lost has been found. We should gather the community, and that should be a party because someone is home. Someone's been rescued. Someone's been found. Even Jesus goes to the point of dying in order to rescue us. He takes on death so that we can be found. He takes on death so that we can be welcomed home. That's the invitation. That's a story. I would love to let that sit, let that roll around. I'd love to pray, and then Kelly's going to come up, and we're just going to take an opportunity to sing together. You can sing, we can listen, we can kind of take that in, because that's a lot. That's a lot, right? I don't know about you, but in my time in studying and like working through it, there's so many times there's just like a roller coaster of, whew, that's hard, that hurts, that's, ooh, boy, that's something. And then there's also this, wow, look how God never gives up. Look how God just keeps on coming after people and inviting them into a new way of life, to have new eyes to see. What an amazing God. Look at how Jesus, with people constantly having these diseases at him of diagon guzo and ekluck muck, guzo or whatever it is, like constantly having this bleh at him, and instead he's just like, come on, I got another story for you. Hey, I got another story for you. Might you pick up on it at some point, for the love of all? And there's an invitation. Ah, bless God. He doesn't give up on me and you, even in our muttering, but there's an invitation. I'd love to pray, and then let's sing and listen and reflect together. Gracious God, grace-giving Father, God, you invite us to be more, to see more. You invite us, God, to have new eyes. You give us new eyes. You forgive us in our mess. You love us despite our tendencies to drift, to wander, to lose the plot. And yet you constantly, God, I bless you, God, that you keep inviting us back onto the path. You invite us to follow you, to be with you. And then, God, might you even now be giving us new eyes to see our neighbor, like our neighbor who lives next to us, and our neighbor at the gas station, our neighbor at the restaurant, our neighbor who is in the cubicle next to us and drives us completely bonkers. But you give us fresh eyes to see them as created by you, and as someone who you are constantly and relentlessly inviting home. Might we have eyes that live with hospitality? Might we participate in welcoming them to you, inviting them to you? Might we have fresh eyes, not to judge, but to love, not to be stingy, but to be generous. God, continue to wake our hearts up, massage our hearts to move from bitter to generous and loving and kind, caring and inviting. God, I bless you for the ways in which you're always doing that with us. Continue to do that with us, God, and help us to turn that toward others. God, we bless you for this time that we can sit in your truth, in your love, in your grace, and in your invitation. God, I ask that you continue to have your way even in us now as we sing, as we reflect. We give you the honor and the glory, and we bless you for this. In the name of Christ, amen.
chorus is something we all know. You guys sound amazing singing it. I encourage you to sing it with me one more time, but place your hands in your lap with your palms facing up in a way of just receiving from the Lord and just kind of allowing Him to kind of just grab hold of your heart and just feel His presence. So let's sing this one more time.
Offer word of benediction, blessing, if you will, that we would absorb this. But before we do, just a reminder, Tuesday, if you want to do some taco time, you can just show up on Tuesday at 6 p.m. If you want to bring your own food, if you want to order food, you can do that. Just you can either email Laura Lee or just give me your email and I'll send out an email on which you can email Laura Lee. It's just a good time. Right? A word of benediction, a word of blessing, an invitation. May you, Walker Harbor Church, may you, each of you, may you receive the invitation. May you receive the invitation to have new eyes, fresh eyes to see that God loves you right where you are, right here, right now. May you have an open heart and an open mind to receive God's love for you. He created you. He loves you. And may you receive that now. And may you, as you leave here to be the church, may you have fresh eyes to see your neighbor. May you have fresh eyes to see those that are different than you and begin with they are created in the image of God. And as you do that, may we be a better, stronger community. Know that the grace and peace of Christ goes with you all. Amen.